Hello, world! Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. And we are preempted tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM New York. However, we're here on in the studio of PRN.FM, and I'm here with Joe King. You can listen to the stream on the internet or on your telephone, 712-775-6850, if you have unlimited minutes. For more information, you can go to our website, pcradioshow.org.
For those who want to hear the podcast of the Personal Computer Show, this show, on your telephone, the call-in number is 1-701-719-1003, 1003. And all you have to do is dial this number, and you'll listen to the RSS feed. Pick up which episode you want to play by dialing 1 for the current episode and 2, 3, 4, or 5 for the next oldest episodes. If you need to hang up or to take another call, no problem. When you come back in, you'll resume playing where you left off. Or you can always pause or rewind or fast forward it as you would with your own unit. Tonight, here at the PRN broadcast, we're having a special guest this evening, Dr. Rebecca Mercury. For those of you who don't remember the last few times we've had her on the air, she's one of the world's leading experts on electronic voting and ballot tabulation. She's the one who has always told us in the past that the machines that were coming in had to be more secure, had to be better operated. Today, she's also a foremost digital forensics investigator. And if you want to ask a question of her later on in the show, or you want to share a comment or an opinion, you can call us live on the toll-free number 888-874-4888. To call into the show, 888-874-4888. But first, a quick roundup of the personal computing news this week. Hank?
Yes, we mourn the passing of a man who started PC Magazine, PC World, and many other publications. David Bunnell passed away last Tuesday at the young age of 69. I remember back in 1975 when he was working for MITS, which was a company founded by Ed Roberts, and he created that first personal computer called the Intel 8080. This machine was called the Altair 8800. Bunnell had the job of writing the documentation and starting a newsletter. In 1981, just after IBM's announcement of the IBM PC, Bunnell and a few of his friends started PC Magazine working out of his house in San Francisco. The first issue was an immediate hit because they had a feature interview with Bill Gates. Not long thereafter, Bunnell's financial backer sold the magazine to Ziff Davis, and the vast majority of staff left to start work at PC World at rival IDG. David Bunnell also started the magazine Macworld for IDG in 1984. Another major item of announcement was AT&T will acquire Time Warner for $85.4 billion. And the deal combines content from Time Warner, which has a film studio and a vast library of entertainment, and with AT&T's distribution network of mobile services, broadband and TV in the United States and Mexico and parts of the South America. That's quite a deal.
Hank, let me interrupt just to say that AT&T made the deal because they really needed content. And look what Time Warner had. HBO always wins a bunch of Emmys, Cinemax, a bunch of other movie companies. Hey, for them, it was a way to get into the content business.
Well, with the deal, it's a part stock and part cash deal. The shareholders would receive $107.50 per share, of which half of it would be for stock and the other half would be for cash. However, the stock I just looked at it just before coming in, it's not at 107. It's closer to about 87, 88. And the reason is because it is subject to a long period of approval process. It's going to be reviewed by the Department of Justice. And right now, I just want to also say that AT&T recently had acquired DirecTV in July, and they made the largest paid television provider in the United States. And they will be offering, by the way, they just made the announcement today, DirecTV services for $35 a month. That is a major price differential.
Is that $35 over and beyond what they'll have to, the customers will have to pay for the AT&T service?
We don't know. They said that the television part is, in other words, the direct TV, the television part is $35. Of course, as you know, most people, when they get the services, they have the internet part, they have the television part, and they have the telephone part if there's a telephone service. So we'll have to see how they bundle it or the basic services.
I know with the DirecTV, you have to have the ability to put up a satellite antenna. And if you live in my apartment building, you can't do that.
Well, I think that's going to change, Joe, because I've been testing various antennas. They're getting smaller and smaller. And if the it happens to be inside your living room and it doesn't stick out the building, it's getting there.
Well, I think that the broadcast antenna, which that is a lot different from a satellite antenna.
Well, I don't know, because I had been doing some preliminary testing, and I'll be reporting on it in a future show, but the ANTOP, A-N-T-O-P, they call it the antenna, but I call it an external antenna. But it's a very tiny, it looks like a dish, about, 12 inches, and you could really mount it inside. Of course, your spouse would probably say, Joe, get that off the wall. But in testing, would you believe you can pick up 60 stations that is in the air?
I do believe it, but...
By the way, that's not cable.
When you're finished testing it, bring it over to my apartment, and we'll see if it works in Manhattan.
Yeah, we'll do that. The FCC, by the way, reached an agreement, a $48 million settlement with T-Mobile, and T-Mobile will pay a fine and provide benefits to consumers, totaling $48 million. The FCC investigation found that the company policy allows it to slow down data speeds when T-Mobile's so-called unlimited plans exceeded a threshold level.
What was the threshold? Did they tell you?
No, they didn't tell me, but I am a T-Mobile user, and I got a notice two nights ago saying that through the end of 2017, I think I saw that, I have unlimited data service now. Originally, I had gigabytes, and now it's unlimited.
But
let me tell you what's unusual about that. If you object to getting unlimited, call us, and we will we'll put you back on the old program, where they throttle you.
I'm always confused by these.
I was confused by that. I called my son. He says, "No, do not call them up." I think he did the right thing. Last Friday, there were major outages, or at least there were major outages. It started out in the East Coast, and it traveled to the West Coast, and it hit part of the other countries. And
outages of what?
The Internet.
The whole Internet?
The whole Internet.
You mean I couldn't get on and check my email?
It actually depended on who you're trying to get to. In other words, if you were trying to get to a small guy, you probably could do it. But if you were trying to get to Facebook and, in other words, the major Internet portals, you would have a hard time, because what happened is that their Internet address got – not that it got hacked. What it is that they go through DNS addresses to be verified, and the company doing it that did the verification, DYN, got hacked. But they didn't get hacked.
They didn't get hacked, Hank. They had a distributed denial of service attack.
And
that is something that you, I, and the next guy next door doesn't understand. Why don't you explain that to me?
Okay. What it is that the Internet of Things devices, okay, which is in cameras and in routers and, all these devices, okay, tens of millions of these gadgets with IP addresses, they were running with the Mirai malware. Somehow it got in there. They didn't have the malware, but what it is that they had default passwords, and it's M-I-R-A-I. I think it's called Mirai malware. And what it did is that there are so many Linksys or routers out there. There's so many cameras out there. There's so many, with common, and they all had default passwords. And people didn't change them. And I think many consumers weren't told to change the passwords. And all they did was go in and just, they hacked those.
Well, you mean that the the bad guys, the black hats, went into all these different objects on the Internet of Things and planted the Mirai malware, and that malware set up what was called a denial of service attack. And the way that works, or a distributed denial of service attack, is that they send out a request for acknowledgement to a site, in this case to the DYN domain name server. And so many requests for information go out to them that the site crashes. It just can't handle all the information. In this case, they were talking about millions and millions of requests per second.
Well, actually, there are open DNS addresses, and it turns out that the alternate route of using open addresses, because it's open, okay? They're not verified at all. Like, I happen to know one of them because it's so easy to remember, 8,8,8,8. So that's an open one. And they found out that by using the open addresses, kind of saved the bacon for some of the companies.
But what was interesting about this attack is it went like, have you ever seen in a football game, the stands?
Oh, the waves.
And that's how this worked. The wave went across the country, and by the time it hit the West Coast, the East Coast was back up and running again.
Well, let me introduce someone on the air, because she might be able to add more light on this. Our special guest this evening is Dr. Rebecca Mercury, and she's the founder of Notable Software, and she's one of the leading experts on electronic voting and ballot tabulation. She's also a digital forensic investigator, typically working for criminal defense on a wide variety of cases, including hacking, murder, and financial fraud. And if you wish to ask her a question a little later on, or share a comment or an opinion, you can call us on a toll-free number, 888-874-4888. Let me repeat that number. If you want to join the discussion and you have a comment and you have a question to ask her, it's 888-874-4888. And I believe she's on the air with us now. Hey, Rebecca, how are you?
Yes, I am. Thanks very much for having me on this evening. And I'm good. And good to be here.
Do you have any comments about last Friday's attack?
Well, it was interesting that at Princeton University, they were actually having a conference, an all-day conference on the Internet of Things that very day.
Of all things, and, right? Go ahead.
Right, and they, of all things. And it was, you know, like an academic conference. I wasn't there, but a good colleague was. And they weren't using the Internet, so they didn't notice that this hack had actually occurred. But what was interesting that he reported to me was that they all, basically all of these researchers, were basically saying that there isn't anything, you know, there's nothing being done with, I mean, the Internet of Things, you know, for a $5 device, you're not going to be concerned with security. You're not going to be putting in, you know, a lot of hardened security on it. So basically it's extremely vulnerable, and this just happens to be one vulnerability that, you know, sort of slipped through the cracks.
Slip through the crack? Are you kidding me? This is like no one even thought about it? I mean, with millions of devices?
Well, that's what they were saying there, apparently, was that, you know, nobody was really, it's not that they didn't know it could happen, they just weren't protecting against it. It's just not something that they were going to protect against. Again, these are very inexpensive devices. They're not going to put hardened security on it. It's just, you know, going to drive the cost up. So it sort of defeats the purpose of these little itty-bitty devices that are going to, you know, just be out there talking. Now, you're going to have more problems like this, because things like the Amazon, where you can, you know, control everything in your home, you can just imagine, you know, all of a sudden everybody's lights start flashing and, you know, all sorts of crazy, you know, denial of service attacks could occur that, you know, could have all sorts of deleterious consequences. So you know, it has not really been a primary goal of the developers of these devices to include a lot of security, or any security.
Rebecca, this is Joe King. And the last time you and I talked on the air, I think it was during the election of Abraham Lincoln. I'm not positive about that.
Alexander Hamilton.
But when Hank and I...
More popular politician.
when Hank and I first got into this whole interest area of computing, that was before you were born, but nobody was concerned with security. And the word hacking was a nice word. It was a good word. It wasn't a criminal word. And why should you bother to have something criminal done? Because if you hacked in, information was supposed to be free and all these wonderful things. Well, obviously, that's changed today. And my question is, since it's easy for the people with the Maria malware to get into millions of cameras and doorbells and thermostats and whatnot, how easy would it be for them to use that same technique to foul up our election?
Well, I do want to address that, but first let me just say that there were people, including at AT&T, you mentioned AT&T earlier, the Morris worm was actually launched out of AT&T,
oh, yes.
But there were developers there. You know, Morris is the younger, and there was Morris the elder who had warned about it at conferences, but he was sort of laughed at. So we don't know whether, you know, he put his son up to doing this, you know, or maybe coached him, but some people think that, but maybe that, you know, maybe that really didn't happen. But still, it was his son who was working there, you know, as a summer intern who, you know, maybe accidentally launched this worm. So it's been a concern, but again, did people do anything about it? And the same is true about the voting machines. I mean, I've been testifying about voting machines since the late 1980s, and I, and at that time, only a handful of people, I mean, we're talking like a dozen people, were really concerned about this and were saying how dangerous these things were. It's gone back and forth. You know, after the Bush versus Gore election, a whole bunch of vendors said, well, we can solve all this hanging chad by going to electronic voting machines. And then more and more computer scientists, not a lot at first, but more and more computer scientists joined me and some others who are prominently saying that, you know, this is wrong. There's no paper trail. There's no way to audit the election. And so basically it sort of got wound back. And now, right now in the country, I understand the statistics are it's about 40% are voting electronically, about 60% are voting on paper. But even the paper ballots are being scanned electronically. So the problem you have is that with anything that's done by the computer, there is the possibility of, you know, malware or deliberate alteration of the software, reprogramming of things like voter cards, things like that that could actually affect the outcomes of the election. So none of that has changed. We've been talking about this, as I say, since like 1989. You know, if anything, in some ways it got worse, but as I say, with some of the paper, you know, as long as they retain the paper and can recount directly from the paper and not from scans of the paper, you do at least have that possibility for a legitimate recount as long as the paper is archived properly. So I myself, I'm in New Jersey. My county votes entirely on computers, but if you request an absentee ballot, you get it on paper. So I've been doing that for at least a decade since they started using electronic machines here. So we try to recommend that people do that, vote on paper, and then I go the one extra step where I actually go to the place instead of mailing it because you don't know what's going to happen in the mail. I actually go there and in its envelope hand it off. So I know at least it got there. I know how I voted it on the paper. And those two steps you don't really have with an electronic voting machine. But I think the larger question that you're asking is, can the elections be hacked? Now, again, in the early days after Bush versus Gore, there were some computer systems, including, I believe, the Diebold ones that were being daisy chained together, or that they're also being connected to the internet by phone. Also, they could relay their votes totals back at the end of the day. Well, all of that was really looked upon as very dangerous. And I don't know whether that's been defeated or turned off in all of the voting systems in all of the states, but in the recommendations, they do now no longer recommend this. But you do also have the possibility of when the precincts are aggregated together, it's not on the voting machine computers, but on other county computers or, you know, jurisdictional computers. And they are posting those results to the internet, so there is a chance of contamination there, and those results could be posted incorrectly. Of course, you know, you would hope that they would check and make sure that they're up there correctly, but that is a problem. So that's one problem.
Well, let me ask you, Rebecca. You say 40% of the voting is now with electronic machines. How many different types or standards of electronic machines are there? It's not one standard.
No, there's not one standard, and even if they're even from the same vendors that are selling them, there's really ES&S is the election systems and software. I think it is ES&S was the largest vendor of voting systems, but there's a couple of other vendors that are out there. There were some smaller companies that tried to get into the business again after Bush versus Gore when money came out for communities to buy these things. But by and large, there's a very small number of vendors who were selling these, and some of them gobbled up some of the other companies. But it's not that so much. The fact is that each state has its own election laws, so there's different rules. So they have to be programmed differently for each state. And then, of course, the ballots can differ from place to place depending on, you know, in different counties, there's different things on the ballot. So you're really talking about a multiplicity of differently set up systems, which does make it harder to come up with one sort of global hack or attack. And I'm not saying that it isn't possible, but the fact that it is sort of multiple different things in different states and different counties in different states makes it a little bit harder to do that. But vulnerability... Okay, go ahead, ask your question.
Rebecca, when I voted in the primary a few months ago, I had to take my paper ballot that I had marked up over to a scanner and put it through the scanner. But
right.
But my friend who lives over in New Jersey didn't have a paper ballot. And I wonder how many of that, you said 40%, have the ability to question the electronic data and go back and count the paper ballots.
Well, the thing is that when you're talking about the electronic machines, a lot of those are still the touch screens or they're like a panel of push buttons, and it goes into the computer. We don't know what happens to it once it gets in there. We do know that there's been vote flipping where you actually even see it on the screen, even Homer Simpson cartoon, they have it showing, you know, it happened to him. So, I mean, it's so commonplace. Many people have seen it. They've recorded, you know, actual, you know, cameras. You know, they take their camera out and saying, whoa, wait a second, this is really happening. It's, you know, at first people were saying, oh, they're just lying about it. But I've seen it happen. I actually saw it happen it was basically a clearance to see whether a particular type of voting machine would be allowed to be used in the state of Pennsylvania. And even though that happened, the examiners actually passed that voting system and decided that it would be okay for use, which really boggles the mind. So you really don't know when you're dealing with the fully electronic ones, you don't know what's going on inside, and there is no way to do really an independent recount. Now, some of them have like a ballot under glass that, you know, it sort of prints it and you can look at it. In New Jersey, there's a little LED panel down at the bottom, so if you press the button, you can look down and see. So if you press the button for, you know, one candidate, then you can look down at the LED, but nobody thinks to do that. They don't even know to do that. But if you look down there, you should see the name of the person that you just selected. But sometimes people have seen another name, so it's, you know, it can be misprogrammed, and if it's misprogrammed inside of the computer or altered inside of the computer, well, then you're voting for somebody else that you didn't think you were voting for. So that can happen. And in fact, Hank sent me a video link from Symantec, where they were showing, you know, they purchased some voting machines at auction and then showed how to change things on them and vote multiple times. And, you know, it's great that they finally chimed in on this, but, you know, I bought voting machines at auction 10 years ago. I still have one in my cellar. So actually, I think I have two in my cellar. And, you know, we were doing that. Princeton University was doing that 10 years ago. Nobody was listening to us. So you know, it is possible to do it. But
I know it's possible to do it, but, you know, I bought an electric heater the other day, and I noticed on the cord there was a certificate from the Underwriters Laboratory, and I found out by
how interesting you mentioned that. Yes, go ahead.
Well, I found out by contacting Consumers Union what that really meant. Is there a UL for voting machines?
Well, and that's the interesting thing. At one point, I was involved with the IEEE, the Institute of Electrical Electronics Engineers, the committee that was trying to come up with better voting system standards that were being recommended to the federal government. And because they had authorized the IEEE to come up with these rules. And at one point we talked to UL, and they were not interested in doing it because there was no money in it for them. They get paid by the manufacturers to do this. Basically, it's the voting system guidelines that we have in the United States of America are VVSG. They are called voluntary voting system guidelines. And whether a state wants to adopt them or not is up to the state.
Rebecca,
states have not adopted the standard.
I'm going to put you on the spot, okay? Which state has the strongest security in voting, and which state has the worst security in voting?
Well, I would have to say that they all have flaws.
But some are worse than others.
Well, we could go to New Hampshire because they still vote paper ballots hand counted in many of the counties. So they are actually, they sit there and at the polling place and they count them by hand. Once everybody has voted, either at the end of the day or if there was only 10 people, like they usually have some precincts that are very small, so all the people come in first thing in the morning and then they vote and then they sit there and hand count them. So that is actually, that's really sort of the gold standard. And you notice that in the primaries, you notice that Bernie was getting different results where there were caucuses than where there were other types of primaries. And in the caucuses, essentially, it's a voice vote. Everybody in the room knows how everybody else voted. Now, I'm not saying we should go to non-anonymous voting, but it is in many states for the primaries. And in those states where there are primaries, Bernie Sanders was winning hands down. I mean, he was making big wins. Then you go to these other states, you know, where they were not having that type of accuracy and that type of integrity where anybody in the room could say, hey, you said that Bernie didn't win here. He did win here. We were all there. We saw him win. So we don't have that type of, you know, it's not just accuracy and integrity, but it's the ability for the voters themselves to actually provide a checks and balances on the election, and also the election officials. They have no way of providing checks and balances. Again, even with the scanners, at the end of the day, they push a button on the scanner, out dumps a piece of paper. They don't know if that piece of paper actually recorded, you know, the vote tally correctly. We don't know, and we've even proven that the scanners can also be affected as well adversely.
So, Rebecca, I heard the other night one of the major candidates of a major party saying the elections were fixed. And now you're saying they probably were.
Well, I'm not saying that we know that they were. Well, all I'm saying is that if someone wanted to fix them or if multiple people wanted to fix them, they probably already did it long before that particular candidate started railing on about this. So it would have already been in place. And it would actually have to occur with collusion of both of the parties. And there are people, including myself, who believe that is feasible. And we have not been able to prove this because they will not let us inspect the machines.
Well, wait a minute. What can we, the listening audience, do? We're all very proud about the exceptional country that we live in, the world's best, most important democracy. What can we do as individuals to assure that we get back to that stage where somebody came in with a pen and made an X on a piece of paper and handed it to somebody else, and we knew we were getting who we were getting?
Correct. And that is, we have an acronym for it. It's called PBHC, Paper Ballots Hand Counted. And we've had a movement to try to go back to paper ballots hand counted. And that would really be sort of the gold standard of counting ballots.
Yes, and absolutely. But you say movement. I never heard of it.
Okay, well, I'm sorry that you haven't heard of it, but it has been going on. And for sure, there would be the need to talk about this further. And now that people are again attuned to it, during the last 8 years, I can tell you nobody was calling me. Nobody really seemed to care much about election integrity. All of a sudden, it's back in the news again. So, you know, I was called by, you know, different news agencies to get quotes from me, and everybody's interested in it again. And I think that's a good thing. I'm not saying that it's a good thing the way it's being described, because I think there's a difference between someone saying that they, you know, that they believe that the election is rigged, and not also saying that with their millions of dollars, they have a war chest of money that they, if they lose, they're going to go and file, because they have the right. If you're a candidate, you're running, and you lose, then in every state where that person loses, and in every county in every state where that person loses, they can go in and ask for an actual recount. And then there would be, the local laws would be applied, where in many states there are paper ballots to recount. Now, in Florida is using paper ballots. They have scanners now. They tried the touchscreens for a while. Those were horrible. So they went back to paper ballots, but again, it's you mark it on the paper. But they also passed a law that made it illegal to recount via the paper.
Exactly.
The only way you can recount in Florida is to recount by the scanner. And if we don't believe that the scanner's right, then you're not really getting a recount. So,
well that's again, what happened the last time around when it was Gore versus Bush in Florida. They asked for a recount one side,
yes,
and they couldn't get it because the courts didn't support it, or there was a different law. I'm not sure of why.
Correct.
My question is this: why aren't people? I'm refusing to believe that. Hank, how many millions of voters do we have in this country? 300 or something like that?
Live or dead?
Both. But I can't believe that nobody wants to have, or nobody is concerned about having an honest ballot. Now, Rebecca, you talk for a moment about an organization that's trying to get us back to a paper ballot or something, a paper backup to the electronic ballot. But that's you. You're one person. Now, you might tell me that 57 of your friends are also doing it, but I was very honest to you when I haven't heard of it. I'd be happy to join that organization, but I first have to know about it. And I'm sure there are millions of others who would be happy.
I
know people who would be, I could get to write to their Congress critters or to their senators or whomever. But they don't. I don't know what to tell them to write, and I don't know how to explain to them the problem. They don't know there's a problem.
The problem that we have had with trying to get our voices heard more publicly on this issue is that, well, first of all, we're referred to as Luddites, despite the fact that I have a PhD in engineering and computer science.
You're a Luddite.
I'm still referred to as a Luddite.
You're a Luddite.
And exactly. So basically, a lot of the people who want to go back to this more primitive method, you know, are basically, you know, being derided and marginalized. Many of us have been marginalized.
Well,
we're no longer invited to the table to hearings and things like
that. I can understand
that
if you want to go back to my theory of a name and you make an X next to the name and put it in a paper box. But what about what we have right here in New York City? I fill out a paper ballot, I walk it over to the scanning machine, I scan it. At the end of the day, it's one-to-one against somebody, and Hank says, I want a recount. And they open up the box where the paper scanner, where the paper ballot is, not where the scanner is, and they manually count it.
No. Actually, as a poll watcher in New York, the recount means they go back and look at the summary total of each machine.
Yes. That's right. They look at the summary total.
Just only the summary total.
Just the summary total.
So that there is there's no error in transcription.
But if a candidate
Both of you wait a minute. That is not a recount. That's an electronic check.
That's what I'm saying.
I am telling you, in New York, that's how they define a recount.
Well, if I demand a recount, I'm not going to do it through the corrupt poll watchers like you. I'm going to go to the courts.
Right, exactly. If you go through the courts, and I have to say that New York, because I did, you know, I had been testifying in New York about voting machines since the late 1980s. So, we did try to make sure that laws were implemented such that there would be the opportunity to do manual recounts from the paper ballots. Now, I don't know if any of those laws have changed from what they were when they were first, when they first got these, you know, the scanners implemented. But I think that we do in states like New York, and again, we would have to check the laws there, if someone did file, it's usually a candidate or citizens in behalf of the candidate. So if they filed the protest, you'd have to go through the courts, but then you could get the recount. I was involved in one out in Orange County, California, where there were only 7 votes difference between 2 candidates. And we sat there and looked at, you know, basically ballots one at a time and said, okay, that's how that one was marked. That's how that one was marked. And, you know, so you can do this. So, but only in states where they have made the laws this way. I can tell you in Florida, they will not allow you to recount. All you can recount from is those papers that get printed out by the scanner. So
and then you have the problem of the hanging chad.
Rebecca, I have a follow-up question for you. A couple weeks ago, the Daily News had reported that 20 states had experienced registration hacking activities. Can you give us more information on that? And
I wanted to get to that. That is where our real vulnerability is, because it used to be, I don't know, you know, you guys might be old enough to remember this. I am old enough to remember this. When there was a big polling book that it had all the names of the people on paper, and you'd go in there, you'd sign your name, and then they'd compare your signature to the signature in the book and make sure that that was, you know, really you, you know, and you could see sort of how your signature changed over the years. It was very interesting. But they don't do that anymore. Now, most of the polling books are now electronic. And some, like in New Jersey, they do print them out on paper. So at the precincts, they have a paper set of it, and they're not looking them up online. But some of the states, they're looking them up online. And again, just like that Internet of Things hack that we were talking about earlier, you could bring down the Internet so that you wouldn't be able to look up the, you know, the person's name in the polling book electronically. Well, now, I know that Homeland Security has been trying to look into this. There was a hearing a few weeks ago that I watched on C-SPAN where members of Homeland Security and other officials said that they offered to any state or county to have their systems inspected to see whether they were vulnerable to this type of hacking. They said that not all states, in fact, only a small percentage, I think maybe 20% of them, actually took them up on that. And then who knows what paces they're running them through. And if a hacker is crafty, they may already be into those things. So we, you know, this is where I think you have a big opportunity for voter disenfranchisement.
Well, I have a much bigger problem. I have a much bigger problem here in New York. I went to vote at the primary, and they did have a registration book, and they did pull it out, and I did have to sign next to my signature.
Okay.
And because, unfortunately, I was walking with a cane that day, I couldn't bend down properly, and my signature didn't look at all like my previous signature. Nobody cared.
And they just let it go.
They didn't even look at it.
Now,
because of that, I was curious, and I signed up to be trained as a election poll person this year.
Good.
But unfortunately, I wasn't feeling well this past Saturday, and you can't be the poll person unless you go through this 4-hour class of instruction, which probably says if somebody signs, compare the signature. So I missed that part of it.
Rebecca, I have a kind of a tangential question relating to electronic voting. Voting is one thing. What about medical devices? Can you imagine if someone was playing around with a pacemaker that's in me or anything like that?
Oh, these are all, you know, a very big concern. And, you know, it's not just medical devices. It's the testing equipment, you know, where they're doing radiation scans of you and, you know, all sorts of things.
Well,
in the hospital.
The reason why I brought the pacemaker is that, like, one of the things was They had a default password, and it wasn't changed. Can you imagine the doctor saying to me, you got to come back into the hospital because we forgot to change the default password. We have to open you up to do it. I mean, are you kidding me?
Exactly.
I doubt if they have to open you up to do it, Hank.
No, seriously, I think they just
have to stare at you and think very hard on the new password, and it gets transmitted to you. I watch Star Trek all the time.
These protocols are, you know, are of concern in medical devices. That's some of the, you know, the most written about problems that there have been with settings that were incorrect, and, you know, deaths unfortunately resulted. But getting back to the poll workers, one of the reasons why we don't want internet voting, I mean, just imagine that. That's crazy. But people are talking about it. But I think that your poll workers are also a good front line of defense. I was a poll worker for many, many years, first in Pennsylvania and then when I moved here in New Jersey. And when you're a poll worker, the people who are coming to your poll, if you're assigned to the place nearby where you live, you know those people. Those are your neighbors. And if you see somebody that you know moved out 6 months ago and doesn't live anywhere in the neighborhood, you should raise some skepticism about them voting. Or if the dead guy from down the street all of a sudden he's voting, Rebecca,
you're talking about a tiny town. If I was a poll worker here, I'd be looking at 1,500 or 1,800 faces that I have never seen before in my life. I've lived in the same building for over 30 years, and I know maybe 5-8 people in the entire building of hundreds and hundreds of people.
I'll tell you how
simple it is. You want it to be simple? Have my thumbprint or my retina or some biologic factor?
DNA.
DNA takes too long.
Well, but all of those are a problem because, again, you know, people have a right to privacy, and this would be a matter of public record, and then it could be misused by law enforcement, or you could just imagine.
Rebecca, I
would not suggest.
Wrap up the segment. If anyone has any questions for you, is there a website that they can go to or an email address that they can write to?
Right, sure. NotableSoftware.com. It's all one word, Notable, N-O-T-A-B-L-E, Software.com. And if you go to that website, there's a tab on the left-hand side for voting information. There's links to me, and there's all sorts of information. Some of it's pretty stale because I haven't really updated the election stuff lately, but it's all there. All the stuff we just talked about today, that's all still in play. It's all, you know, mentioned there in one way or another. So I'd suggest that people go to NotableSoftware.com and they can also email me as well there. So that would be great.
Rebecca, we talked, you and I and Hank and maybe Burstein at that time, and this must have been 8 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, the exact same conversation we're having tonight, except back then most states did not have electronic voting, and you were talking about what they should put in. Now we do have electronic voting, and you're talking about what they should put in. This is ridiculous. How can we, as citizens of this country, do something?
Well, I think that it falls on a lot of different people. I think that people should not be forced to just concede the election. And we're talking to everybody. You run for dog catcher, you lose by 3 votes, you should file the paper saying that you want to have a recount and then follow through on that. You don't have to have a lawyer to do that type of thing. So everybody who's running for election, if there's a close election, then they should be concerned and they should start raising that instead of being intimidated. Oh, the party's not going to like me if I do that, and, you know, so on and so forth. So I think that's where it starts with the candidates.
No, that's where it should end. That's where it should end, not where it should start. It should start long before that.
True.
How do I know we need a recount if the count was fooled around with in the first place? Maybe I won the election by 40%, but it shows I won it by only 4 votes. How do we get to our, as individuals, we can't do anything. Obviously, the Congress critters that we have in Congress don't really care about what an individual says. They're worried about getting reelected, which means a lot of individuals, or they're worried about financing their election, which requires a rich individual. How do
right.
normal people, is are there organizations like
that,
the that we can join?
One thing that can be effective is that now the places that have the electronic voting machines, a lot of these are just breaking down now. So because they're 10 years old, we told them they weren't going to last that long, you know, and they are breaking down. So and this was millions and millions of dollars were spent on these. So basically, the different localities where they're going to be replacing those have to have hearings, you know, procurement hearings. And so you can stay in touch with your local officials, your election board, and try to find out when those hearings are going to happen. And we did this here in New Jersey. Didn't help any. We still end up with these machines. We got all sorts of promises from the vendors that they would have certain things. There was even a lawsuit in New Jersey to make sure that the voting machines did have paper trails and things that you could recount. But basically, they were bullied by the vendors into not doing it. But we did spend many, many years, quite a number of us, going to these hearings, testifying at them. Professors from Princeton University were there doing it as well. You know, when we were there at the hearings, we made ourselves known. I think we need more of that. As these procurements happen again, there's going to be millions and millions of dollars, you know, maybe even in the billions of dollars of, you know, our own public funds. They're going to be used to buy all this stuff again, which only lasts another 10 years. And we want to go for the better types of systems that are paper-based to begin with, where they can actually be hand-counted.
Okay,
you know,
I'm going to do a wrap-up on this, and you can stay on with us. What I like to do is just make a comment in jest that can you imagine if these voting machines had a lithium-ion battery in there and it's going to blow it up?
To have lithium-ion batteries, but yes, I can imagine.
No, because actually,
it's terrible. It's terrible.
Now wait a minute. They probably have a little battery in there for the date and time stamp, right? and the scan the scanner requires some kind of electronics, right?
Well, the older ones have big batteries. You know, some of them were using like big car batteries back in the day.
Hank, what I think would really be good is if we could convince every individual out there. So before they vote for somebody, ask that person what they have done to make the voting more honest. And Rebecca, I don't even know what the question should be, but if you would draw up a question that everybody should ask before they pull the lever to vote for somebody, I'd be happy to have that mounted on our website and some other websites.
It is already there. I did have a list of questions to ask your election officials. And it's, you know, maybe a little stale at this point. You know, maybe I should rewrite it. But it's on that website, the electronic voting portion of NotableSoftware.com's website. So I'll be happy to give you a pointer to that after we get off the air. And if you want to link to it, that would be great.
All right. Let me just say that the Personal Computer Show is really an extension of all the computer clubs in the regional area here. And we do have some public service announcements to make. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on software patents. Now, that's an interesting subject because I railed at all these software patents we have. The presentation's on Tuesday next week, November 1st, 7:30 p.m. They will be meeting at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. And by the way, all these meetings are open to the public, and they're free. There's no charge for it. The Westchester PC User Group will be having a presentation on contact marketing November the 3rd, next Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty site, 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor, White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, ACGNJ, and I'll just give you the topic. If you ask me to explain what it is, I'm going to just give you that dumb look, which is Lambda Calculus and Other Esoteric Impractical Topics. No, Joe, don't ask me what it is, okay?
No, I was going to ask Rebecca what it is.
I do actually know what it is.
Oh, you know what?
Part of my PhD.
I'll tell you what. Let me finish the announcement, and you're going to tell me what the Lambda Calculus and other esoteric topics are. It's next Friday, November the 4th at 8 p.m., and the meeting is at Scotch Plains Rescue Squad in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Now tell me, what is it?
It's a mathematical methodology. So basically, it's a formulaic methodology that is used in certain types of programming methods. That's it succinctly. If you want me to really explain it, it would take pages.
Is it a technology that's used in Notable Software Corporation?
No, we don't use it in Notable Software, but it is used in theoretical computer science, basically to derive certain types of equations that could be used for like searching and all sorts of different types of very deep formulas.
The Rockland PC User Group will be meeting on November the 8th on Election Day at 7:15 p.m., and they'll be meeting at the Rassel Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Mall in West Nyack, New York. The New York Amateur Computer Club will be having their general meeting on November the 10th on a Thursday. That's 2 days after Election Day at 7 p.m., and the topic is how Internet voting leads to a stronger democracy. I know you like to comment on that, Rebecca. It will be held at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 414, and a photo ID is required. You want to comment on that?
No, I think I'll pass on that.
Okay. And finally, the Brookdale Computer...
Don't offend the people at NYU.
No, because I told you who the speaker was, and you had a couple of comments, and I think you're being very wise and being very diplomatic.
I'm trying to be.
No,
it's
seriously.
Rare for me.
No, you know what? No, seriously, it is a different perspective, and, you know, we like to hear different perspectives.
We do?
Yeah.
No,
true.
We do, okay. The Brookdale Computer User Group will be meeting on Friday, November the 18th, Exploring Internet Crowdfunding, and that's going to be at 7 p.m. in Building MAS, Room 100, and they'll be meeting at the Brookdale Community College in Lincroft, New Jersey. And there's one final topic I'd like to go through very quickly because we only have a few minutes left, and that's the fact that Yahoo, who's been in the news for all the hacking that's been done to them that affected 500 million accounts, they're asking the U.S. government to release the fact that they were requested to give the information, and they asked the ACLU to help them out on it. Any comments on that, Joe?
Yeah, I have one comment. Every time one of these commands come through to a corporation to do this, that, or the other thing, they're accompanied by a gag rule or a gag order. Now, if it happens to me, I'm very likely to break it and end up in Devil's Island prison or what have you. But Yahoo is a corporation, and they don't want to get fined millions of dollars, so they obey the rule. Now, I know some people say, well, that has nothing to do with the hacking. I say it had everything to do with the hacking because they would never have tried to build that back door without getting this kind of a subpoena. The fact that they did it incompetently, well, that's why you would fire people, but they tried to obey the law. Now, nobody believes that. So they're saying to the ACLU, please help us get the government to admit that they made us do it. They didn't make us do it badly. They just made us do it. We did it badly on our own.
Well, it's more than that, Joe, because I think that I feel it's a misdirection where they're making you focus on that part of it and the fact that, yeah, they did screw up. I mean...
So how is it a misdirection?
Why don't they say that, yes, they were asked by the government to do it, and they screwed it up?
They can't. It's against the law for them to say, yes, we were asked to do it by the government, and this is what the government put in. And it's very possible that some of the requests the government made forced them into a screw-up, but we won't know it until we see the subpoena.
You have to understand, back in 2014, when their chief security officer said, hey, don't put it in. You've got problems with it.
And he quit.
And he quit in protest.
Yes, but we don't know what he was protesting. We don't know what did the subpoena say. If the subpoena, for example, we wanted to bug your house, and the subpoena said, you must allow us in the back door. Don't lock the back door, and you get robbed. Whose fault is it?
Well, the latest this afternoon is that Verizon has put out a release saying it does matter, and it does affect the value of $4.8 billion that was offered. And they're coming up with a new number. And I think Yahoo is trying to say, wait a minute. We're really worth that much. But you know what? The damage is done. 500 million subscribers got hacked.
And how many? I, for example, don't use Yahoo Mail, but Yahoo has my name and password on several other lists. I immediately canceled that and changed my passwords.
Well, let me just, Rebecca, thank you for joining us, and I hope that you'll come back and give us an update on electronic voting. And
you're welcome. Very nice to be here, and I hope everybody does go out and vote, and those people who lose elections should definitely protest.
Absolutely.
And
Rebecca, I'm going to get hold of you later and by email, and you'll give me something to mount on our website and some other websites, because we really want to get this electronic voting squared away.
That's great. That's really great. I'm glad to hear that. That's really good. I'm glad we had a chance to expose a lot of these different issues.
The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PC Radio 212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM and 9 p.m. on WBAI-FM. In the meantime, stay in touch, keep on computing, back up, and I'm not going to say vote, just only vote once. And on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week, happy computing, and good night.